So we are on page 254. I signed paragraph 18 of chapter 11, The Master of the Work. I see the today we are not me, so John Robert, me, and then Jeffrey. Does someone have bell?
You have your bell, remember? Yeah.
Okay. Couple of minutes in the switch. I
Here's
will have bell.
Radica
Yeah.
now.
Hi, Radhika.
Hi, sorry I was late a little bit. Have you started reading?
No, we're
No.
just going to do our meditation, so you can join us for the meditation. So.
Okay. Good, great. Thanks.
I would reframe the order. So it's John Robert, me, Radhika, and then Jeffrey Jen.
Radhika, we're starting on page 254. The transcendent, who is beyond all world and all nature, and yet possesses the world and its nature, who has descended with something of himself into it, and is shaping it into that which as yet is not, which as yet it is not, is the source of our being, the source of our works and their master. But the seat of the transcendent consciousness is above in an absoluteness of divine existence, and there too is the absolute power, truth, bliss of the eternal, of which our mentality can form no conception, and of which even our greatest spiritual experience is only a diminished reflection in the spiritualized mind and heart, a faint shadow, a thin derivate. Yet proceeding from it, there is a sort of a golden corona of light, power, bliss, and truth, a divine truth consciousness, as the ancient mystics called it, a supermind, a gnosis, which this world of lesser consciousness, proceeding by ignorance, is in secret relation, and which alone it maintains it and prevents it from falling into a disintegrated chaos. The powers we are now satisfied to call gnosis, intuition, or illumination are only a fainter, are only fainter lights of which that is the full and flaming source. And between the highest human intelligence and it, there lie many levels of ascending consciousness, highest mental or overmental, which we would have to conquer before we arrive there or could bring down its greatness and glory here. Yet, however difficult that ascent, that victory is the destiny of the human spirit, and that luminous descent or bringing down of the divine truth is the inevitable term of the troubled evolution of the earth nature. That intended consummation is its raison d'être, our culminating state and the explanation of our terrestrial existence. For though the transcendental divine is already here as a Purushottama in the secret heart of our mystery, he is veiled by many coats and disguises of his magic worldwide yogamaya. It is only by the ascent and victory of the soul here in the body that the disguises can fall away and the dynamis of the supreme truth replace this tangled weft of half-truth that becomes creative error, this emergent knowledge that is converted by its plunge into the inconscience of matter and its slow partial return towards itself into an effective ignorance.
For here in the world, though the gnosis is there secretly behind existence, what acts is not the gnosis but a magic of knowledge ignorance, an incalculable yet apparently mechanical overmind maya. The divine appears to us here in one view as an equal, inactive, and impersonal witness spirit, an immobile consenting Purusha not bound by quality or space or time, whose support or sanction is given impartially to the play of all action and energies which the transcendent will has once permitted and authorized to fulfill themselves in the cosmos. This witness spirit, this immobile self in things, seems to will nothing and determine nothing. Yet we become aware that his very passivity, his silent presence, compels all things to travel even in their ignorance towards the divine goal and attracts through division towards a yet unrealized oneness. Yet no supreme, infallible divine will seems to be there. Only a widely deployed cosmic energy or mechanical executive process, prakriti. This is one side of the cosmic self. The other presents itself as a universal divine, one in being, multiple in personality and power, who conveys to us when we enter into the consciousness of his universal forces, a sense of infinite quality and will and act and worldwide knowledge and a one yet innumerable delight. For though him we become, for through him we become one with all existence, not only in their essence but in their play of action. See ourselves in all and all in ourselves. Perceive all knowledge and thought and feelings and feeling as motions of the one mind and heart, all energy and action as kinetics of the one will in power, all matter and form as particles of the one body, all personalities as projections of the one person, all egos as deformations of the one and sole real I in existence. In him, we no longer stand separate, but lose our active ego in the universal movement, even as by the witness who is without qualities and forever unattached and unentangled, we lose our static ego in the universal peace.
And yet there remains a contradiction between these two terms, the aloof divine silence and the all-embracing divine action, which we may heal in ourselves in a certain manner, in a certain high degree, which seems to us complete, yet is not complete because it cannot altogether transform and conquer. A universal peace, light, power, bliss is ours, but its effective expression is not that of the truth consciousness, the divine gnosis, but still, though wonderfully freed, uplifted, and illumined, supports only the present self-expression of the cosmic spirit and does not transform, as would a transcendental descent, the ambiguous symbols and veiled mysteries of a world of ignorance. Ourselves are free, but the earth consciousness remains in bondage. Only a further transcendental ascent and descent can entirely heal the contradiction and transform and deliver.
For there is yet a third intensely close and personal aspect of the Master of Works, which is a key to his sublimest hidden mystery and ecstasy. For he detaches from the secret of the hidden transcendence and the ambiguous display of the cosmic movement an individual power of the divine that can mediate between the two and bridge our passage from the one to the other. In this aspect, the transcendent and universal person of the divine conforms itself to our individualized personality and accepts a personal relationship with us, at once identified with us as our supreme self, and yet close and different as our master, friend, lover, teacher, our father and our mother, our playmate in the great world game, who has disguised himself throughout as friend and enemy, helper and opponent, and in all relations and in all workings that affects us, has led our steps towards our perfection and our release. It is through this more personal manifestation that we are admitted to some possibility of the complete transcendental experience. For in him, we meet the one not merely in a liberated calm and peace, not merely with a passive or active submission in our works or through the mystery of union with the universal knowledge and power filling and guiding us, but with an ecstasy of divine love and divine delight that shoots up beyond silent witnesses, beyond silent witness and active world power to some positive divination of a greater beatific secret. For it is not so much knowledge leading to some ineffable absolute, not so much works lifting us beyond world process to the originating supreme knower and master, but rather this thing most intimate to us, yet at present most obscure, which keeps for us wrapped in its passionate veil the deep and rapturous secret of the transcendent Godhead and some absolute positiveness of its perfect being, its all-concentrating bliss, its mystic Ananda.
But the individual relation with the divine does not always or from the beginning bring into force a widest enlargement or a highest self-exceeding. At first, this Godhead close to our being or immanent within us can be felt fully only in the scope of our personal nature and experience, a leader and master, a guide and teacher, a friend and lover, or else a spirit, power, or presence constituting and uplifting our upward and enlarging movement by the force of his intimate reality inhabiting the heart or presiding over our nature from above, even our highest intelligence. It is our personal evolution that is his preoccupation, a personal relation with him that is our joy and fulfillment, the building of our nature into his divine image that is our self-finding and perfection. The outside world seems to exist only as a field for this growth, and a provider of materials, or of helping and opposing forces for its successive stages. Our works done in that world are his works, but even when they serve some temporary universal end, their main purpose for us is to make outwardly dynamic or give inward power to our relations with this immanent divine. Many seekers ask for no more or see the continuation and fulfillment of this spiritual flowering only in heavens beyond. The union is consummated and made perpetual in an eternal dwelling place of his perfection, joy, and beauty. But this is not enough for the integral seeker. However intense and beautiful, a personal, isolated achievement cannot be his sole aim or his entire experience. A time must come when the personal opens out into the universal. Our very individuality, spiritual, mental, vital, physical even, becomes universalized. It is seen as a power of his universal force and cosmic spirit, or else it contains the universe in that ineffable wideness which comes to the individual consciousness when it breaks its bonds and flows upward towards the transcendent and on every side into the infinite.
Whose turn is it? Is it not? It's not mine, right?
Yeah, but we have finished the section, so if you or someone else wants to make some comment, questions. So usually when there are these three stars, it means end of section. And it's usually question time, but not necessarily, obviously. We can also continue.
Well, I would like to discuss, because I feel like this was a little... Some of this was like very interesting, but I mean, obviously everything, most of what's your Aurobindo writes is not immediately, it's not, you're not going to understand it, but there's a lot of very interesting things that he says here. Can you give us a minute just to like skim what we just read? And
I agree, Radhika. It seems to have to do with the sort of individual, I mean, it's a kind of individual versus universal, I guess, is the register about this text.
Yeah, like totally. I was also kind of, that was kind of in my mind, like how he says that you have these relationships, and a relationship is always with an individual entity, right? Like it, when you have a relationship, it's with a person, the personified aspect. But then like he also talks about the transcendental. So, I mean, there's a lot of like different opposing, I don't know what to say, categories. So if you look at page 256, so do you want, so Jeffrey Jen, do you want to continue?
No, I must admit, when I was reading this, I was thinking, I wish Radhika would step in with one of her questions, because you really have a good way of anchoring the discussions down into the reality of the world in ways I know, that I really enjoy.
I'm trying to like not be so mental. Like I feel like all my questions are like too concrete. I was trying to be less mental, but like I don't know.
No, I think it's fine.
So here's the thing. So like on, if you read the bottom of page 255 and the top of page 256, he talks about the universal divine, one in being, multiple in personality and power. And then he says, for through him we become one with all existences, not only in their essence, but in their play of action. See ourselves in all and all in ourselves. I mean, that's worth thinking about, you know, like, I mean, I'm just talking, thinking about like my own personal like life and reflecting on it. So like, how do you see yourself in all and all in ourselves? Like, in what sense does he mean that? Like, is he saying that you unite with other personalities through what you share in common? Because I don't think he means something like that. I don't know what he means by that sentence. See ourselves in all and all in ourselves.
So and then,
he says something very interesting. In him, we no longer stand. So this is what that really struck me. The last line of the top paragraph on page 256. Like he says, in him, we no longer stand separate, but lose our active ego in the universal movement. So the thing that I don't understand is, when he says, in him, we no longer stand separate. So he says, if we are outside him, we are separate. And the him is a personified being, or it's like it's a transcendental reality. So what is that? Is it personified? Is it transcendental? But it is, the him here is what unites us. And he refers to a universal movement. And I'm not sure what that is. Like, what is this universal movement? So he says a lot of things in that last sentence. In him, we no longer stand separate, but lose our active ego in the universal movement, even as by the witness who is without qualities and forever unattached and unentangled, we lose our static ego in the universal peace. So he already talks about the active ego at the beginning of the sentence, and then he talks about the static ego at the end of the sentence. So that single sentence has so many concepts in it. Like so, for instance, what is the him that he refers to? In him, is it personal? Is it transcendental? Is it individual? And then he says, active ego. What is the active versus the static ego, and what is the universal movement? And then he says, he refers to the witness without qualities. So how does the witness relate to the him at the beginning of the sentence? I mean, I can just forever go on breaking it down, but I guess that's too mental. Like, how do you understand what he says in a non-mental way? He says a lot in just that one sentence.
Yeah. If you look at the beginning of that paragraph, he talks about two aspects of the divine. He says the divine appears to us here in one view as an equal, inactive, and impersonal witness spirit. So that's the impersonal divine, that's the impersonal witness. So some religions or some traditions don't admit of a personal divine, but of a kind of an impersonal divine force. And Sri Aurobindo is taking account that. So here he talks about that. Then if you go down a little bit farther, he says, this is one side of the cosmic self, this impersonal part. The other side presents itself as universal divine, multiple in personality and power, with whom we can enter into personal relations. So he's talking about these two aspects of the divine. And then in that last sentence that you were talking about in that paragraph, he says we lose our active ego in the universal movement. That's cosmic consciousness. So it's the universal divine is the cosmic consciousness. It's active in the cosmos. It's the movement of cosmos. And also, as the witness who's without qualities and forever unattached, we lose our static ego in the universal peace. So the ego that's not doing anything, that's not active, has this correspondence in the divine, and we
but don't even understand how can the ego be static. Your ego is what propels you to action, right? Like, or even thought. I mean, like, your ego is the force that I mean, I think of it as the force that motivates you, that dictates your thoughts, that dictates your actions. When you are not doing anything, when you are in a static condition, you won't have an ego, right? How would you have an ego when you're not doing anything? Well, or thinking anything? So
I take it to mean the ascetics who go off into the cave, they're not active. But they're still separate.
In samadhi, the ones who attain samadhi, right?
Well, but they have to get there first. And so they lose their self in inactivity. They lose their active self, their separation. Remember, ego is another word for ego is separateness. So they lose their separateness, not in the active cosmic consciousness, but in this kind of this passive, almost like a nirvana state, uniting with the divine impersonal instead of with the active person. But I want to take this step back a little bit farther. I think this is a really dense passage that we just read. I think it'd be really worthwhile to read it again, because we've gone all the way through it once, and I mean, it's so loaded, it's so full. I think it'd be really worthwhile to just read the passage again, and we could keep some of these questions in mind.
I agree with that. I don't really have any answers, but you were sort of saying, Radhika. So I don't think of it as other people exactly. I think about it as the cosmos, including other people, right? So I don't think we're talking about everything. When he says see other things in you and you and everything, he's talking about the cosmos, right? But I also, in terms of not doing this intellectually, I put myself into a situation of poetry, because you can't write poetry, you can do it intellectually, but it doesn't have a lot of sense. With poetry, you have to sort of spread out your attention and your mind into a different way. So I tend to think of this as a kind of poetic exercise rather than an intellectual exercise.
I mean, I don't, because I'm a student right now, like my reflex is to try and break it down. But yeah, like, I mean, this is not one of those works that you can approach like that. I mean, I don't think that's the best way, but I can't resist it either. Like, I'm thinking like, oh, what are the oppositions he's making? What are the concepts he's introducing? Like, it's there. I always think of it that way. I just don't know how to open to it. Like Andrea was saying the other day, like, you just have to open to it. And I don't get that.
Yeah, but I think there are different ways to approach these things. One is poetry, and another is the mental point of view, as you say. I like to use the metaphors, to think in terms of intuitive metaphors, which have not to be taken literally, but can give perhaps, a sort of intuitive, subliminal intuitive understanding of things. For example, when we have, you have this frequently all over Sri Aurobindo, not only Sri Aurobindo, but I would say in all yoga literature, that there is the one Brahman that is all there is, and yet we live in a universe that is not only one, but there are also many. Yeah? And so for the mind, this is a contradiction. Is there one or are there many? There is only this or that. It cannot be both. But when one has his transcendent experiences, one realizes that all is the one that expresses itself in itself as many. It multiplies itself, but yet it is, so to use a metaphor, the typical Vedanta metaphor is that when you look at the sun on a rippling water, you see many suns. On the rippling water, there are a lot of images of many suns. And you might be taken by this illusion that there are many suns, but it is an illusion. It's there is only one sun. So the realized person is a yogi that gets into a state of nirvana or some supramental state and realizes that all the multiplicity, the personalities are yet the expression of the same one only personality, universal personality. So it's, you can use these metaphors, for example. The other metaphor, very typical metaphor, is that first we are separate from this divine consciousness and then have this realization. It's like a drop that melts into the ocean. When the drop falls into the ocean, there is no drop, there is only the ocean. But yet there is something. You don't lose your consciousness, but you get the awareness that you have always been only the one ocean, and you are no longer the drop.
So that's the analogy that I think Mother uses when she says that you lose the ego sense, that you just kind of merge with the ocean and you stop being the little drop.
Yeah, it's also an analogy you find also throughout the Vedanta. Okay. Yoga philosophy, yeah, but these things we can only understand, so to speak, or by realization. When one gets into at the samadhi level, then everything appears, and they tell us that we have always been in that state, but we are not aware of that.
So, I mean, to make this really concrete, I mean, because if you guys don't object, so when I see, so would it make sense to say that if I'm able to identify other people's, so he talks about the universal movement, right? So if I'm able to identify movements that occur in other people as my own, is that saying that I see myself in them and themselves in me? Like he talks about seeing ourselves in all and all in ourselves. Is it something to do with the quality? So I'm seeing their qualities in me and my qualities in them. Is it something to do with the active? So he talks about the active ego, right? So this union that you experience with others is through the active ego, or it happens through the widening of the active ego.
It's a stage. See the qualities that you have in other people, and you identify with their qualities. It's a stage, but it's still too, you know, it's them and me. So there's still separation there. So it's a start of widening. The widening of the ego means the gradual lessening of separateness. But when you have the experience of that other person is me, or I don't feel the boundary between us, then you've taken another step in that direction. And what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here in the universal identification is cosmic consciousness, where you have the experience that you are that, you are all of this, you know, you're this table, that desk, and you're this book, and you're this other people, and you're this computer, and you're all of that, and that is. That all of that is one thing, or one something, one consciousness. So there's stages, you know, that we go through as we evolve. first we, you know, like, you know, when we're two or three, we learn to share. So there's something that's quite not quite as separate as it was before. And then when we fall in love, we have an experience of merging. And then, you know, the honeymoon is over. And so we begin to feel the limits of that merging. So there's all these stages that we go through. And Sri Aurobindo's saying, he says, the intended, the ultimate, the bringing down of this higher truth is the inevitable term of the troubled evolution of the earth nature. It's destiny.
Where was it? The bringing down, where was it?
It's at the near the top of page 255. He says, yet however difficult that ascent, and he's talking about the ascent to the transcendent there, he said, that victory is the destiny of the human spirit. So there's all these different stages that we go through of widening until the ego is so widened that it's not separate anymore. It's not an ego anymore.
I like the explanation, but the thing that I'm still kind of stumbling over is that active ego versus the static ego. So he talks about the universal movement and the universal peace. And the active ego is what I think, so the active ego widens and identifies with the universal movement. The static ego widens and identifies with the universal peace. So is there like a fundamental contrast between the universal movement and the universal peace? Because he says that, right? Like in that sentence that I was reading, I think it was.
Yeah, he does. He makes that distinction, and Sri Aurobindo often makes the distinction between the active divine and the passive divine. Those were two of his early realizations. He realized the active divine and the passive divine. When he had the experience with Layli, he experienced the passive divine.
That's the nirvana. Because Layli
gave him nirvana. You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that must be like, because my mind is so active like all the time. Like I can't imagine a state where like you're literally going into oblivion, because nirvana translates, the closest English word is oblivion. Why would anyone want that?
Well, I mean, sometimes we want it because our mind is so active we can't get away from it. You know? We try to quiet it down, and it's going yak, 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 yak all the time. And also the active mind is very creative. So it's creating all this so-called reality in front of us. And maybe we don't like the reality so much. Maybe there's a lot of things we look and see in ourselves and in others and in the world, you know, global warming and injustice and all this kind of thing. That we'd like to get away from. And one way has been to escape inward or upward, to leave the world, in other words, to leave the manifestation, because it's very disturbing. And so there's been a whole spiritual movement in that direction.
That's the Buddhist movement, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not just the Buddhist. I mean, there's that aspect of Christianity too.
Oh, Christianity has it too?
Very much, yeah. I read some years back the autobiography of Cousin Zakas, who wrote
The Odyssey, a modern sequel.
Yeah. he was looking for something, and he went to all these monasteries in the Mediterranean basin, and they were all about getting out. You know, going to heaven, getting away from it. And there, you know, that's true in a lot of the Eastern traditions too.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
They just want it.
I appreciate your, I'm not sounding very coherent right now, but John Robert, you mentioned the active mind. But here it's talking about the active ego, which is not quite the same thing as the active mind. I mean, the active mind is, you know, so Radhika, when you were saying you're very active right now, I think you're talking about the active mind, not the active ego. Say that. So I think one has to be careful with the terms here. And so it come back to this idea that ego is about separation. So active ego is an active process of separation, versus passive ego is a passive process of. I'm sort of thinking out loud about this as I go. I don't know, John Robert, if you have any insight into that. I don't think it's the same thing as the active mind and the passive mind. I don't think that's what we're talking about today.
Well, you're right. They're not exactly the same thing in mental terms. But the active mind is, in the way that I was talking about it, it's bouncing around from one thing to the other because it can't connect. And so it's, by definition, separate. And as you were saying, I think a little bit earlier, or somebody, maybe it was Marco, was talking about how the mind can sort of do unity, but it's much better at doing distinctions, which are differences, separating.
Definitely.
The mind is really good at that. It's not very good. It kind of has some of a sense of unity, but it's much better at analyzing and taking things apart. Whereas if you go into the heart center, you can experience it if you look, when you take a walk and you look out at the world with your mind, you see all these different things. And when you bring your consciousness down in your heart and you let your heart look out at the world, it's different. It's like you're looking at your relations or something. It's a different quality to it. So, yeah, I mean, I take your point, Jeffrey, that they're not exactly the same. But I think the active mind is usually, active, at least in the way we were talking about it, is usually the ego-driven mind.
Because, I don't disagree with this idea that I do disagree with the idea that the mind is only about the categorizing and discrimination, because the poetry is also comes from a mental, it involves mental powers to do poetry. And poetry, at least in some of its aspects, is not about categorizing. It's about a kind of an identification. I mean, the poetry is interesting that way because it's about being very precise about things. So categorization comes into it, but then you have to soften up the mind in order to get this one thing is in everything and everything is in one thing. That's built into poetry too.
I mean, Jeffrey Jen, that was very nicely put. I couldn't have put it that way. It's very articulate, but that's how you feel when you read Savitri, right? Like the way he joins up different things. Yeah.
I mean, you call it the heart, John Robert, but I think that's still a part of the mind. I don't think that's only our emotional reaction. I think it has to do with a different aspect of the mental state. In fact, the whole reason, the whole argument of Aurobindo, that the mental is involved and necessary to the process of rising through the levels is because the mental has also this other capacity and not just the discriminating separate.
What kind of capacity is it? I didn't get this point. What is this other kind of capacity of the mind?
An integrating capacity. It's not just a discriminator. The mind is also an integrator.
Is this the mind, you think?
Yeah.
Of course it's the mind. It's the neurological structure of our, it's also the mind. I mean, to sort of say it's not the mind is, you can do that. You can play that game and say, this is the mind and this is not. I disagree. I think it's all part of the mind. It's just a different aspect of mind.
The mother and Sri Aurobindo talk about gradations of mind, right? So like at the lower gradations, it acts as a like an analytical and you know, like what John Robert was saying, at the lower levels, it takes things apart. But as you rise higher and higher in your mind, then you learn to integrate things, I would imagine. Like, I don't think at the lower levels of mind, you could integrate things.
Yeah, in fact he speaks about higher mind, intuitive mind, illumined mind, overmind, and supermind.
Yeah,
in this sense, it's all mind, but this is a word, no? But the supermind is something very far from the intellectual mind, no? And the more we see holistically oneness, the more we go towards this holistic way of seeing of the supermind. And yeah, it's about gradations. It's perhaps we are losing ourselves a bit in categorizations ourselves. Yes, but at any rate, what I wanted to say also, can we not relate a bit these things also to our personal experience? For example, this thing with the active and static ego. Doesn't it happen to you? Sometimes I am in this state of peace, calm. There's something in me that is absolutely static, and yet I'm doing things. And when I'm driving, for example, it happens to me. I drive, and then I almost wake up. I see, but I was driving from A to B and even didn't realize it. I was doing something and there was this perfect calm and going. And I saw, perhaps because I'm also influenced by the landscape, if it's perfect, but particularly beautiful, and I get into the state of resonance and harmony, there is a static ego that is in peace. And yet there is some outer part of myself that does things. And in fact, in the terminology of interior yoga, there is also the vital ego, there's a physical ego, there's a mental ego. It's not just one ego. Also our body has a sort of ego, so to speak.
But you seem to be describing the static mind, not the static ego. When you talk about driving in this state, mm-hmm. I think you're talking about the static mind, not the static ego.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know in the discussion he's trying, so there's a nuance between what one means by static ego. Ego does not equate to mind, otherwise we'd be sunk.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't know if the ego is an expression, is there's some place where some yogis say that the ego is just a thought. But a thought of who? Of a universal mind. But in any case, it's the end of paragraph 19. We lose our static ego in the universal peace. So I was more thinking about this last sentence.
I agree with the sentence. It's just that it's the stat and the... You're describing the static mind. I think he's saying something slightly different here. So I'm trying to understand. I don't fully understand it. But.
Yeah, but this is a sense of self-existence that I would not describe it as a thought, as a mental state. But I mean, I'm describing my own personal experience, perhaps. You know, when we speak with words, we understand something very different using the same words. But so I'm just saying that I don't have this very big problem with understanding the static and the dynamic. There is always the static and the dynamic. What I have much more problem to understand when he speaks of the for example, this the witness spirit with immobility that yet is active somehow. This witness spirit, this immobile, immobile self in things, seems to will nothing and determine nothing. Yet we become aware that his very passivity, his silent presence, compels all things. This, for me, it's complete contradiction for the man in mental terms, because if something is very passive, silence, determines nothing, is immobile, how can it compel all things to travel even in their ignorance towards the divine goal and attracts even through division towards a yet universalized oneness? So I think this is a classical example of things that if you read them intellectually, you won't get at anything meaningful. That is something that we have to feel inwardly, as some truth inside of us, that silence is not necessarily something that prevents action. And it can, in silence, compel all things. But my problem is much more on that than other things. So it's probably because every one of us is very different in reading these things.
You're muted, right?
What do you think it means? Actually, that sentence, even I looked at it and it was like, yeah, so he says his silent presence compels all things to travel, even in their ignorance, towards a divine goal and attracts through division towards a yet unrealized oneness. So the silence compels. That's a very interesting notion, you know, that the something that does nothing, wills nothing, has no presence.
Well, he doesn't say it has no presence. We become aware that his very passivity, his silent presence, so it doesn't say he doesn't have a presence.
Oh, yeah, okay.
In Savitri, there's a reference to this kind of divine being. And he says, and I don't remember exactly where it is, I think it's in Ashwapati's Yoga. He talks about these divine forces that are above humanity and that they're indifferent to humanity. They don't come and rescue humanity. And he says, by their silence and their indifference, they compel us to travel on, to aspire.
Can I say that this silence is something that imposes a direction on everything around it? So like the silence imposes a direction on the moving aspect of the divine, on the active aspect. So the silent aspect doesn't do anything, but it gives a direction to the inactive, static. The silent, inactive, static aspect imposes a direction on the active, dynamic movement aspect of the divine.
Yeah, I don't know whether that expression does it or not. I'm just going about what I remember from what Sri Aurobindo said in Savitri, where he's talking about these divine forces that are silent and passive and witness. They're witnesses. They're watching, in other words. There's a presence there, but they don't come to help. We pray to them, it doesn't do any good. They're not interested in helping. They don't do any kind of active helping. And he says by their presence and by their inactivity towards us, it's like it spurs us, because we're aware of them, and we can see that we're not there, and it kind of stimulates the flame of, let us move then towards that direction, because, you know, somebody's not coming to rescue us, so we have to develop it in ourselves. Of course, Sri Aurobindo says it way, way more elegantly than that.
I mean, but does he say that these are presences that do not help? Like,
yes,
I never.
He does.
In Savitri?
In Savitri.
Mm-hmm. Why
yeah,
would
so it's very
divine,
interesting to read
divine,
that.
So I thought all divine personalities will help the human being when you pray to them. I think that's the whole relationship between the human and the divine, the personified divine, right?
So that's not what Sri Aurobindo says, though. I mean, it's interesting because we tend to think of the divine in our, you know, in our kind of growing up ways as though just the way you talk, you know, we have a guardian angel who's a portion of the divine who helps us, and or we have, you know, or we're named after a god or something, and all of these things. But Sri Aurobindo is talking about this impersonal part of the divine, which is not a friend, it's not a helper, it's impersonal. And yet, he says, it still is a spur to our evolution.
But he says also that there is the beloved.
Sure.
There is a personal aspect of the divine to which we can relate through bhakti yoga. No? Mm-hmm. So, and it is still the same one being.
Because we're mental, and he's speaking to us as mental beings, he says, there's this side and there's this side. They're different, and yet it's all the one divine.
Yeah. Another analogy that is very frequently used is that of seeing us in a mirror. If we believe that the person that we see in the mirror is someone else, then we think that the so-called awakened person realizes that the other persons are all ourselves. So in a certain sense, we are talking to each other here, and it's just a theater, a sort of play, that the same person is playing in itself this illusion of being John Robert, Marco Masi, Radhika Shunda, and Jeffrey Edwards. But we are all the same being.
Do you think of it as different movements of energy? So like each person is a movement of energy from the divine, which develops in time in its own way. So
there's also the analogy of the almost equal to this previous analogy that each of us is a wave in the ocean. But I think this is a bit misleading because the waves and the oceans are different, separated waves. In this case, however, these waves are all connected to each other. There is no real separation.
You think of it as a drum. When you hit a drum, you get all these standing waves across the surface of the drum. So each person is a different section of the standing wave, right? So I love that way of thinking about it, Radhika, beautifully said. By the way, I've thought back, I have some insight on this thing about the active ego and the static ego. So I think what's going on is the ego, if we recognize the ego is a part of the mind, it's the part that gets stuck into the separation, then the active ego is talking about the active mind, but in its separation state. And the static ego is talking about the static mind, but in this separation state. So they're related to the active and the passive mind, but they're not. We're looking at a very particular part of the mind, which is stuck into separateness. Anyway, it's just a thought about understanding this.
After all this discussion, I suggest we go back and read that passage again now, and maybe we'll, as we go through it, a bit more understanding will come.
Was it my turn, or don't remember?
Yes,
you mean the last paragraph already, or where we began today?
Yeah, I transcended to us beyond.
Yeah.
Start there again.
a transcendent who is beyond all world and all nature, and yet possesses the world and its nature. Sorry, I have been a transcendent who is beyond all the world, because I see he uses natureless capital letter and lowercase letter. We will discuss this later. A transcendent who is beyond all world and all nature, and yet possesses the world and its nature, who has descended with something of himself into it and is shaping it into that which has yet into that which as yet it is not, is the source of our being, the source of our works and the master. But the seat of the transcendent consciousness is above, in an absoluteness of divine existence. And there too is the absolute power, truth, bliss, and the eternal, of which our mentality can form no conception, and of which even our greatest spiritual experience is only a diminished reflection in the spiritualized mind and heart, a faint shadow, a thin derivate. Yet proceeding from it, there is a sort of golden corona of light, power, bliss, and truth. Divine truth consciousness, as the ancient mystics called it, a supermind, a new gnosis, with which the world of a lesser consciousness proceeding by ignorance is in secret relation, in which alone maintains it and prevents it from falling into disintegrated chaos. The powers we are now satisfied to call gnosis, intuition, or illumination are only fainter lights, of which that is the full and flaming source. And between the highest human intelligence and it, there lie many levels of ascending consciousness, highest mental or overmental, which we would have to conquer before we arrive there or could bring down its greatness and glory here. Yet, however difficult the ascent that victory is the destiny of the human spirit, and that luminous descent of or bringing down of the divine truth is the inevitable term of the troubled evolution of the earth's nature. That intended consummation is its raison d'etre, our culminating state, and the explanation of our terrestrial existence. For though the transcendental divine is already here as the Purushottama in the secret heart of our mystery, he is veiled by many coats and disguises of his magic worldwide yoga maya. It is only by the ascent and victory of the soul here in the body that the disguises can fall away, and the dynamism of the supreme truths replace this tangled weft of half-truths that becomes creative error, this emergent knowledge that is converted by its plunge into the inconscience of matter and its slow partial return towards itself into an effective ignorance.
For here in the world, though the gnosis is there secretly behind existence, what acts is not the gnosis, but a magic of knowledge ignorance, an incalculable yet apparently mechanical overmind maya. The divine appears to us here in one view as an equal, inactive, and impersonal witness spirit, an immobile, consenting purusha not bound by quality or space or time, whose support or sanction is given impartially to the play of all action and energies which the transcendent will has once permitted and authorized to fulfill themselves in the cosmos. Let me read that again. The divine appears to us here in one view as an equal, inactive, and impersonal witness spirit, an immobile consenting purusha not bound by quality or space or time, whose support or sanction is given impartially to the play of all action and energies which the transcendent will has once permitted and authorized to fulfill themselves in the cosmos. This witness spirit, this immobile self in things, seems to will nothing and determine nothing, yet we become aware that his very passivity, his silent presence, compels all things to travel even in their ignorance towards a divine goal and attracts through division towards a yet unrealized oneness. Yet no supreme, infallible divine will seems to be there, only a widely deployed cosmic energy or a mechanical executive process, prakriti. This is one side of the cosmic self. The other presents itself as a universal divine, one in being, multiple in personality and power, who conveys to us, when we enter into the consciousness of his universal forces, a sense of infinite quality and will and act and worldwide knowledge and a one yet innumerable delight. For through him we become one with all existences, not only in their essence, but in their play of action. See ourself in all and all in ourself. Perceive all knowledge and thought and feeling as motions of the one mind and heart. All energy and action as kinetics of the one will in power. All matter and form as particles of the one body, all personalities as projections of the one person, all egos as deformations of the one and sole real I in existence. In him we no longer stand separate, but lose our active ego in the universal movement. Even as by the witness who is without qualities and forever unattached and unentangled, we lose our static ego in the universal peace. Just,
and
a,
yet, yeah,
just one quick interjection. So he talks about prakriti here, and like he, the witness spirit he always refers to as masculine, but then the prakriti is female, right? It's always the feminine in Indian philosophy. Prakriti, he says, is mechanical and executive. Why do they? So, and even in Western philosophy, I realize that they So Marco, you were talking about the world and the nature, right? Like you, when you were reading your paragraph, you said that we can discuss it later. You said a transcendent who is beyond all nature, all world and all nature, and yet possesses the world and its nature. So it looks like the nature is something mechanical and executive, whereas spirit is mobile but masculine somehow.
Perhaps so. We will read later going on, and I think it's a couple of hundred pages still. You will see that he distinguishes between a lower nature and a higher nature. The lower nature is the apara prakriti, which is this mechanical nature, but the higher nature is para prakriti. She's still female. Huh? There is no discrimination in the gender. And this is the nature of knowledge. It is a part of transcendent knowledge acting in the manifestation, the dynamic manifestation, space, time, forces, cosmic events, and so on. But it is not the transcendent, but it is still a higher nature which is in contact with the divinity. Whereas this prakriti, he doesn't use the term a para prakriti here, but he means the lower nature. And so, and also other female shakti, the shakti is also female.
It can be mechanical,
but not necessarily.
I'm not insisting on the mechanical part. He always seems to call the feminine the executive. So executive is that which executes, right? So like you conceive of something. So you have a concept and or an idea, and then you execute it. So it looks like these two things are different, right? And I And it seems the same way in Western philosophy, but they call it something. They don't call it Shiva and Shakti. They don't call it Purusha and Prakriti. They talk about it as world and nature or God and nature in I think in Western philosophy. Yeah. But this distinction is because mother. So I mean, obviously, I'm concerned about women's issues, right? So I remember mother once has said somewhere, I don't know exactly where, she says that this distinction between genders is it's just an arrangement on the earth, but it is not like she said, I don't know what she said. I wish I could find the reference. I don't know where she, but she has talked about this male-female distinction. And she said it's just a convenient arrangement and not like something eternal. But I wish I, like, this is something I wish she had talked about in detail, because I really want to understand, like, why did this sexual dimorphism enter evolution? Like, what is the purpose of it? Like, I mean, I wish she had talked more about it. I really wish that she had.
One time she was asked about the distinction, and she said, I don't believe in that. I never understood that. You understand. You answer the question, Amrita. So she threw it to somebody else. She just wasn't going to even deal with it.
She said that? She really said that? That yeah. She doesn't believe in it? Are you sure of this?
I don't remember her exact words, so.
But she did say that, right?
She said, perhaps she said, I never understood this, or I don't. There was some dismissing of it. What her exact words were, I can't remember.
So I'm saying this because, like, a lot of Indian devotees of the mother, right? They are violently against. I mean, I don't. I am not like that. I mean, I. Some of the Indian devotees, and I'm not sure if ashram members also are like this, but I know that some Indian devotees of Mother and Sri Aurobindo are extremely insistent on the male-female like divide. Like they say that women should behave in only this way, and men should behave only in that way, and. Like I see this on Twitter all the time, and they are people who are very devoted to Mother and Sri Aurobindo, but they're like, oh, a woman cannot act like this, a woman cannot act like that, a man cannot act like this. Like they're very much into that gender divide. Like they want these two separate genders. They want it.
As far as I know, there is nothing Sri Aurobindo and mother. That,
they haven't, right? I don't think they have, because I don't remember seeing
them. Find me some reference, some citation, and we'll discuss about it. But
no, because I thought the supramental being does not have sexual dimorphism. So I was very surprised. I was really very surprised to hear these people like I feel like I don't know why, but a lot of traditionally religious people feel challenged by this. I don't know, but they find this notion of transcending gender very difficult to accept. Like they don't want it, and I don't understand why they don't want it. Like what's wrong with that? Is it? Because I see a lot in India, like in traditional Hinduism, and like traditional Hindus who come to the ashram are like this, and I don't know why.
I think it's culture. It's how we have been raised in, from our culture, society, what we have been taught.
But mother has much... not said this, right? Has mother ever said that?
I didn't find nothing of it. So kind. As far as I know, I don't know, I have never been in the ashram, perhaps John Robert can do. There are divisions in the sense, which are perfectly normal, huh? In society, the ashram is divided in one part or the other. I mean, there are toilets for men and toilets for women, but it has nothing to do with spiritual yogic understandings. I find something that Mother Sri Aurobindo has said about that, then we'll discuss. Otherwise, it's useless thing to don't listen too much to what others say. Let's see what they say.
Yeah. No, because I thought that Mother always advocated transcending gender because the supramental being has no gender, right? So for me, I was really taken aback to see these people insisting on these categories. I'm not saying the ashram people are doing it. I don't know. It's just random people on Twitter that advertise themselves as Aurobindo devotees. And I think they are. Some of them genuinely are devoted. I know that also. But they are extremely invested in this is feminine and that is masculine. It's like getting more and more pronounced in India, like recently, because I think now women are more educated, right? Like, or they're just more able to go and be independent, like now compared to like 20 years ago. So a lot of these people are men, and they are like, I think is it just insecurity? I don't know, but they really want women. I mean, they accuse you of, I mean, I don't know. I just found it like, I mean, I was just wishing that Mother had not said something that was making them act like this.
But there is an important question that you yourself, just a couple of minutes ago, you asked. The question, however, is if there is no real distinction between female and male, why did nature bring into existence this polarity? Is there a deeper meaning? Is there an occult spiritual meaning, or is it just biology?
No, Mother said somewhere, I remember mm-hmm. she used the word arrangement. I don't know the reference, but I remember reading a long time ago that she said things have been arranged in this way in the terrestrial evolution, something to that, but she used the word arrangement. So it's mm-hmm. not like a principle, but it's just a convenient arrangement. But she did not say, like, she didn't explain what she meant. Like, she didn't go into details. Mm-hmm. And Aurobindo never touched this subject. Like, he never talked about it. So, or at least not that I know of. But because it is like it is so contested now in India, I wish they had said more about it, you know. It would be very useful.
I think these labels, these arrangements come from our human mind, but it is a fact that in nature there are these polarities. So to avoid any political social discussion, just think of positive and negative charge of particles. That, you know, there can be an electric positive and negative charge, yeah? For example. There are a lot of polarities also in the physical world, and one of these polarities is male female, but beyond that, it is probably what Mother might have meant, is that it serves a practical purpose in the physical evolution, that things come together. There is another duality appearing in John Roberts' video, and it serves some practical purpose, but it has no deeper spiritual meaning other than the one that becomes the two. And then the two, the many. It's an action of division of the one into multiplicity. And also, what is female and male? Why is Shakti female? I don't know. Because why women are active and men are passive? I don't know if that we just make this distinction, and one or the other must have been the one who is passive. So But I don't think that we should take these things more seriously than they are.
So I did a quick search on Google for masculine feminine on the mother Aurobindo, and I found some texts that talk about it. So I don't know that I want to do that right now, but...
yeah, send it to us if you can. If you can email it to us.
Can I do that?
Because that subject is so... It's like full of... Like, at least in India, like, it's become some a very hostile point of discussion. Like, people get... They get, like, really incensed. Like, it's just such a passionate subject.
I'll put it into the chat here. It'll take me a few moments, just keep going, but I will see in a moment. /in. The text is I don't think it's right to look at it right now, but oops. Try this.
Looks like our time's about up today. I just wanted to say that in The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo says that the victory that Integral Yoga is after, which is the descent to the supermind and the transformation of not only of the Purusha, but also the Prakriti, can only happen through the Divine Mother. So ultimately, Sri Aurobindo is, I mean, you could say he's a feminist. He's not. Certainly, she's not setting up opposition between masculine and feminine, but he's saying that the Divine Mother is the key.
So should we finish the section or wrap it up and...
I think we should wrap it up. I'm about saturated with the discussion.
Yeah, discussed a lot. Okay, so let's make a few minutes for meditation. Concluding.
We'll start the section over next time. Thank you. I look forward to next time.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Mischief the Cat also says goodbye to everybody.